Welcome again to Midtown 12 South. My name is Elliot. I'm the pastor here. Joy to have you with us. This service almost didn't happen today because as of about midnight last night, we didn't have any power. But I came up here and prayed and fasted all night, and look, we have power. Hey, real quick, I've got some motion in the back asking me to ask everyone in the room if you could scoot towards the middle aisle. If you've got open seats on your aisle, that'll allow some people in the back to find some open seats easily on the outside. If you could do that, that'd be very helpful. That'd be great. Anyone, how many we need, Matt? You need to hold up hands? Are we okay? We're good? Okay, people may be finding their way in here in a minute, coming down. There are some seats that open up on the outside for those in the back. But we are in the middle of a sermon series on the book of 1 Corinthians. Next week is Palm Sunday. We'll depart from 1 Corinthians next week and read a kind of a traditional triumphal entry passage. Then the story of Palm Sunday, Jesus entering Jerusalem to give his life away, beginning Passion Week. And then on Easter Sunday, the weekend after that, we're actually going to come back to 1 Corinthians, because later in 1 Corinthians, in our study of it, 1 Corinthians chapter 15 is kind of the seminal chapter that Paul writes in the whole New Testament on the resurrection. It's the validity of the resurrection and the implications of the resurrection and the hope of the resurrection. So we're actually going to be preaching Easter Sunday out of 1 Corinthians 15. So we'll depart from it next week, do Easter, and then we'll kind of come back in the book where we were kind of chapter by chapter as we're walking through it this spring. So anyway, we are in our 10th week on this, and just as a brief overview, Corinth was this it city, this happening city, this major metropolis in the ancient world. It was loaded with wealth and gods to worship and networking and social ladders to climb, and it was a booming place. And because of its boomingness, Paul actually says he comes to Corinth to plant a church. He comes with great fear and trembling. Like, he's anxious. Like, this is intimidating to come to this city and try to plant a church. It was second only in size to Rome in terms of the cities that Paul planted a church in. So it's a massive happening, a key city in the ancient world, in the Mediterranean, the Roman Empire. Paul goes, plants a church there. And about 18 months after he leaves, there are major issues going on in Corinth. There's lots of division and lots of infighting and lots of competition and lots of people not applying what they have been told by Paul about the resurrected Jesus to their life and to their community and to their love for each other. He's kind of trending towards the infamous 1 Corinthians 13 chapter, which is all about love. He's saying, y'all don't love each other. There's a little bit of that in here today, which we'll get into. So he has to help them see. He's heard about all these issues. They wrote him a letter while he's in Ephesus, and they write him this letter of like, here's all that we're dealing with, Paul. Here's all the reasons why we can't get along. Here's all the reasons why we're not being the church. So Paul writes 1 Corinthians as a response to the news that he hears about all the issues that they're having in Corinth, which means, and we have to remember this each week when we come to 1 Corinthians, 1 Corinthians is what's known as an occasional letter, meaning Paul wrote it for a specific occasion, meaning there were specific things going on in Corinth that aren't going on everywhere. They're not necessarily going on today. But Paul applies the truth of the kingdom, the truth of the gospel, the truth of Jesus. He says, hey, for all these issues you're having, let me show you the cosmic reality that can kind of reset you, reorient you, and reunite you all in Jesus. And so here's what we're doing. We read these issues that they have and the truth that Paul applies to them, but we're not necessarily going through all the same issues. But that doesn't mean there's not something for us in here, because so what we're trying to do is actually this. What cosmic truth did Paul apply to them in their very specific context that would also help us see Jesus and reorient ourselves to him in our context? Different storylines, different details, but he still is trying to get across some deeper reality, some deeper wisdom, some deeper beauty. And so how are we learning from that, what he's applying to them, even if our storylines and contexts are different? Today is no different. There's a very specific contention going on in Corinth that is not letting them be the church with each other. It is not our issue, I don't think. And so we're going to try to go, okay, what's going on here? What is the issue? We're going to try to understand that first. And then what does he apply to them and how does it apply to us? That's kind of our pathway through it. So we're going to read all of 1 Corinthians chapter 8. It's only 13 verses. And so we're going to capture this is the section where he is dealing with a very specific thing that they can't get along about. 1 Corinthians chapter 8, starting in verse 1, says this. It says, now concerning food offered to idols. I don't think anyone's wrestling with that in here. If so, I'd love to know how you spend your weekends. We know that he put something in quotes. We know that. This is what they have said to him. We know that. It says this, all of us possess knowledge, but this knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. If anyone imagines that he knows something, he does not yet know as he ought to know. But if anyone loves God, he is known by God. Verse 4, he's coming back to the issue now. Therefore, as to the eating of food offered to idols, we know that, and then again, this is, he's quoting their letter to him. He's like telling them, this is the part I'm talking about that you wrote to me about. We know that an idol has no real existence and that there is no God but one. For although there may be so-called gods in heaven or on earth, as indeed there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is one God, the Father, from whom are all things and for whom we exist, and one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom are all things and through whom we exist. Verse 7, however, not all possess this knowledge of what he just said about Jesus, but some, through former association with idols, eat food as really offered to an idol, and their conscience, being weak, is defiled. Food will not commend us to God. We are no worse off if we do not eat. We are no better off if we do. But take care that this right of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. For if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will he not be encouraged, if his conscience is weak, to eat food offered to idols? And so by your knowledge, this weak person is destroyed, the brother for whom Christ died. Thus, sinning against your brothers and wounding their conscience when it is weak, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food makes my, this is him like sharing his own personal conviction now. If food makes my brother stumble, I will never eat meat, lest I make my brother stumble. Okay, that's the word of the Lord. There we go. Amen. Okay, what in the world is going on? Okay, this is very important. The context of this is very important. And he brings up the issue in verse 1 and in verse 4, same phrase. He gives verse 1, and then he gives this aside for two verses, verses 2 and 3, which is a very important aside. We'll come back to it. And then he comes back to the issue in verse 4. But that the phrase in verse 1 and verse 4 lets us know the issue into which he's speaking. Same phrase, two times, right after each other. Verse 1, now concerning food offered to idols, and verse 4, therefore, he's coming back to it now. He had an ADD moment. As to the eating of food offered to idols. So food offered to idols or meat offered to idols is how some translations translate that. What's going on? All right. In the ancient world, Greek and Roman context, everyone that Paul encountered in his missionary church planting journeys were drowning in a world of idols. Greek and Roman gods everywhere. Basically, unless you were a Jew in Corinth, which was very few of them, you came from a life where you worshiped an idol. You came from a life where you had a pantheon of gods. In Corinth, there was a massive temple, like the Roman Empire's temple to Athena is in this town, is up on the hill. One of the major temples to Apollos is in this town. And then there's dozens of other smaller kind of regional temples that are in Corinth. If you became a Christian in Corinth, you had a previous life. 99% of the people had a previous life of worshiping idols. And what that looked like was that regularly you were participating with the eating of meat that had been sacrificed to idols. Because here's what would happen. There were priests and there were temple kind of servers who you would bring your sacrifice to the temple, to Apollo or Athena, and you would want to make sure the God that you were worshiping knew that you were serious and that they owed you something now by sacrificing something to them. Here's my fattened calf. Here's my bull. Here's all my goats. Here are the things so that you're not mad at us and so that you bless us. Apollos, bless us when we are trying to go to war. Athena, bless us, make our children beautiful. We need you to owe us something, so let us sacrifice all these animals to you. And here's what would happen. We'll sacrifice the animals, spill their blood on your altar, and now you see us, but now we have all these dead animals. And so all these dead animals need to be harvested for their meat because we can't just throw away all that meat. So here's what we'll do. We'll throw a temple party. We'll cook all this meat. We'll have a temple festival that continues the worship of this God. Or after we've harvested all this meat of all these animals that have been sacrificed every day and every week, we'll take that meat and sell it at the marketplace down in the town. So basically, if you were participating in some kind of temple festival, which was everybody, or if you were buying your groceries at the local market, which was everybody, most likely any meat you consumed had been sacrificed to an idol at some point. Thousands of sacrifices going on all the time. And so the meat in the city was for the consumption by the people, but it also had been sacrificed to an idol. Okay, so follow this with me now. There were two groups of people in Corinth who knew anytime we eat meat, we're probably eating meat that had been sacrificed to an idol. And then the church in Corinth splits into two groups as it relates to how we come to this dietary conundrum, okay? The first group is this group of Christians who've converted to Christianity, who formerly worshiped idols, but now they confess Jesus is Lord. And Jesus is Lord, and if he is the one true God and he is the God of gods and the King of kings, that means that all these gods we used to worship are frauds. They're actually hollow. They're not real gods. He's the only real God that's ever existed. And so all these gods that we used to worship, they're not real. So if meat has been sacrificed to them, who cares? If meat's been sacrificed to them because they're not even real, it's as if it hasn't been sacrificed to them because there's nothing there. They don't exist. So our conscience is totally clear on eating meat that had been sacrificed to an idol. We can go to temple parties with our friends and eat meat that's been sacrificed to idols. We can buy meat from the marketplace and eat meat that's been sacrificed to idols because idols aren't real, so who cares? Our conscience is clear on this issue, so we are free to eat meat. And their theological logic, Paul confirms. That's what he does in verse 4-6. He's going, hey, the way that this camp in the church is thinking about Jesus and his relationship to idols and what that means about food sacrificed to idols, Paul would say, you're right. Look at this. Look at verse 4-6. He says, therefore, as to the eating of food offered to idols or meat offered to idols, we know, and then he's quoting what they are saying to him, an idol has no real existence. Correct. And that there is no God but one. Correct. For although there may be so-called gods in heaven and on earth, as indeed there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is one God, the Father from whom are all things and for whom we exist, and one Lord Jesus Christ through whom are all things and through whom we exist. Idols aren't real. So Christian in Corinth, your view of the food that has been offered to them, there was a camp that said, we're free to eat this meat. And Paul would say, you're right, because they're not even real. So who cares if food's been sacrificed to them? One group knew that. There's another group, look at verse 7. They didn't know that. They weren't connecting the theology of Jesus is the one true God to their interaction with food that had been sacrificed to idols. Look at verse 7. However, not all possess this knowledge, but some, through former association with idols, when they eat food, it's as if it was really offered to an idol in their hearts. That's how they feel. And their conscience being weak is defiled. Okay. There's some in the group of the church at Corinth who felt like, man, when I sit down to eat at a festival, I'm at a temple party, and I know this meat has been sacrificed to an idol that I used to worship, but now I don't anymore. Or now I'm at a friend's house and he invited me over for a cookout on Friday night, and now like he's cooking meat that was offered to an idol. I feel like, because that's what I used to do all the time, I'm still worshiping the idol. Because that was my whole life before. We would go to the temple and sacrifice, and then I'd have steak with my friends, and it was all part of the same thing. And so now we worship Jesus now. But now when I eat food that's been sacrificed to idol, I feel like I'm still worshiping the idol. My conscience won't let me eat this meat. My conscience is suffocating. I'm sick to my stomach thinking about the fact that this meat I'm enjoying was sacrificed to an idol, and I don't believe in that idol anymore, so I can't eat it. That's what's going on, these two groups. An equivalent, it's not the same, it's not a one-to-one, but an equivalent comparison would be if you know someone or are someone that is a recovering alcoholic, former life was an alcoholic, and you've been sober and you've been clean and you've done the recovery work and it's good and you feel like, man, that's my old life. This is not who I am anymore. But it's really hard for me to go to a bar, or it's really hard for me to enjoy a non-alcoholic beer. People would look at you and go, well, yeah, but it's not alcoholic. It's not the same. And you go, I know, but when I'm sipping it and it tastes the same, it's like, that's not me anymore. And so when I'm drinking even non-alcoholic beer, I can't, that's my old life and this is the new me. I can't do that. So those are the two groups. There's a group that knows this meat that's been sacrificed to an idol, it's not even a real idol, so we can eat the meat because who cares? And then there's this other group who goes, my conscience won't let me do that. It makes me feel like I'm still worshiping the idol, okay? That's the situation. I don't think we have that going on in this church. But here's what we should be asking. What does Paul lead them to do? What's Paul's answer to those two groups who are trying to be the church together? They're trying to exist and worship the same Jesus together, but they see this issue very differently. They can't have barbecues anymore because there's too much contention over this issue. It would have made a whole lot of sense if what Paul told them to do was this, in my mind. Hey, there's this theological reality that Jesus is Lord, which means these other idols aren't real. So, hey, second group whose conscience won't let you do it, you're overthinking it. Like you need to get over it. Your conscience is free. These idols aren't real. Take this truth of Jesus and apply it to your dietary convictions and be free. You need to be able to eat meat. I'm not gonna tell my friends over here they can't enjoy a steak anymore, okay? It would have been great if Paul had done that in about two verses. But I didn't write the New Testament. There's a reason for that. That he doesn't just say to them over here, just believe what's true and let your conscience be free. He doesn't do that. Look at what he says. This is the punch of this chapter. This is the this should be startling to us, what Paul does in the second half of chapter 8. He addresses the first group. He addresses the group who has all of the right theology. He addresses them. Look what he says to them. We're going to read 8 through 13 one time. He goes, but food will not commend us to God. We are no worse off if we do not eat and no better off if we do. Verse 9, he's talking to the group that believes the right thing about Jesus and knows that they are free to eat meat. Look at what he says in verse 9. But take care, though, that this right of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. For if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will he not be encouraged if his conscience is weak to eat food offered to idols? Like if they see you doing it, you're gonna encourage them to do it and their conscience won't let them do it. So you're making it hard for them. Verse 11, and so by your knowledge, this weak person is destroyed, the brother for whom Christ died. Thus, in doing that, sinning against your brothers and wounding their conscience when it is weak, look what he says, you sin against Christ when you do that. And then he's making his own confession. Like, let me tell you how I would handle it if that was going on in my church, is what Paul says. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never eat meat. Me getting brisket is not as important as loving my brother, lest I make my brother stumble. He commands the group that has the right theology, he commands them to use the freedom that they know they have, the right thinking about this whole issue, that they are correct in thinking. He says, yeah, but you need to be using your freedom not to serve yourself, but to serve them. You need to be using your freedom to love them, not your freedom to enjoy what you want to enjoy. Verse 9 is his central point. Take care that this right of yours, you have the right to eat it. Yes, you're free to eat it, but take care that this right of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. Which takes us all the way back to verse 1, which is where he sets up this whole framework for the entire chapter. This is the framework that Paul wants to unroll for the rest of the chapter in verse 1. He says, we know that all of us possess knowledge, correct? That's their words to him. He says, but this knowledge, which he puts in quotes, this knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. What a remarkable statement from Paul. The knowledge is, these idols aren't real, so I'm free. Like my conscience is not bound by what happened to the meat before it got to my dinner table. I'm free to eat it. But they're using their knowledge and their freedom not to love and serve their neighbor. They're using their knowledge and their freedom to look down on them. Knowledge has puffed them up. This is why he has to lead them through the rest of the chapter not to use their knowledge and their freedom only to serve themselves. He calls out people who are right in their thinking. You are thinking rightly. Jesus is the only Lord. These idols aren't real, so who cares what happens to the meat? He calls out people who are thinking rightly, but they're wrong in their actions towards their neighbor. Please don't miss this. This is massive. He calls out people who are thinking rightly about something. He corrects people who are right in their thinking. But he doesn't call them out for being wrong. He calls them out for their pride. They have the right thinking. He confirms it in verse 4 through 6. but their knowledge has caused them to be puffed up in their pride. I am thinking rightly about this, so I can do whatever I want and I don't have to submit to my brother. I can do what I want. And he goes, the way you got to your freedom is right thinking. What you're doing with your right thinking is actually sinning against your brother. And actually, he would say, you've become right thinker. You've become the bigger problem in the community. You're the bigger sinner, not them. Do you think it's possible to think rightly about something, correctly, to have the knowledge about something, but the way in which you handle being right about it, the way in which you apply being right about it, actually makes you wrong? Is that possible? Like, ever been in a marital fight? Nope. Okay, just me. Well, how about this? Like, in your marital fight argument, you know you're right. You know you're thinking about this right. You know what was said and what wasn't said. You know the way forward on this. You know you're right. You know this is the way we should be thinking about this. But instead of letting your rightness move you towards the other in humility, you actually use it to just stand your ground and keep condemning and judging them because they're not thinking about it rightly. If you've never done that, you're not married, okay? And maybe this guy did it yesterday. Okay? And I was like, I am preaching on this tomorrow. Like, what in the world? Or how about politics? Yep. I said that at the 9. I said, or how about politics? And someone in the back goes, oh boy. And I was like, like in politics, and trust me, you cannot tell which side I'm on of anything. I promise a few things you can probably tell what I'm on the side of, but I'm not picking sides here on anything. But you know you're right. You know you're right about what you think about what's happening in Washington and about tariffs and about Doge, and you know you're thinking rightly about it. From both sides, you're thinking right about what is or isn't happening or what needs to be happening or whatever. You know you're right. But with your right view, what do you do with that? Do you use your right view to look down on people who are across the aisle from you? Do you love your rightness so much about a certain political thing that you don't use your right view of it to move you towards the other person across the aisle? You move your right view of it to judge them. We can do this with anything. How about money? Like, you have the right view of money and economics and budgets and how personal and corporate finances should go, and you are right about it. But what you do with your rightness about it is you just love to judge people who don't view it like you. Or your view of emotional health and how to get there. Your view of parenting. Like, how often do you use your view of something, even if it's right, how often do you use it to not spur in you compassion for the other side of things, or love or service or consideration of them, but all you use your right view to do is to look down on others and make yourself feel good about what you feel right about? Paul would say to you, you're puffed up, because that's what knowledge does. That's what being right about something does to us. And then he drops another hammer right after he says knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. Look at what he says in verse 2. This is such a first century throwing shade at somebody. Look at what he does. He says, if anyone imagines, which even that verb is hilarious, if anyone imagines that he knows something, he does not yet know as he ought to know. Like, you think you're right. You think you're so smart. You think you have all this knowledge and you're dumb. That's what he's saying. You think you know everything and you don't know anything. That's what he just said in verse 2. If your knowledge stops with knowledge, it doesn't matter how right your knowledge is. Paul would say, you don't know as you ought to know yet. Because the goal of knowledge, the goal of being right about something, is never an end in and of itself. If it is, you are only thinking about you. If all you want is more knowledge to be right about something. The goal of thinking and knowing right is love. That's what he says here. That's the second half of the first verse, wisdom. Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. The shrewdness of Paul here, it's so masterful what he does. when he's talking about love and knowledge and comparing them, he associates both things, love and knowledge, with activities that increase the size of something, okay? Knowledge puffs up, literally means it's inflated with hot air. So he says, if you grow in your knowledge, if you're right about something, and that's where it stops, you're just right and you're gonna live in the rightness that you have, it's making you bigger, it's just puffing you up with hot air. It's inflating you like a helium balloon. Do you know how fragile a helium balloon is? Like what it can be popped with? It's not sturdy, it's not stable, you can't add anything to it. It is getting bigger, it's just your ego that's getting bigger. It's puffed up. But love, on the other hand, is actually making something, building something far more substantial. The verb he uses, builds up, is a first century construction term. Like, it's a solid rock. Love builds something. Love fortifies something. Love gives other people something to stand on. Love gives other people something to hold on to. Love gives other people something to trust in. Love builds the other up. Knowledge puffs you up. Love builds other people up. And so Paul's trying to say, if your infatuation, Corinthian people, with having the right theology about Jesus is the one true Lord, and so all idols are hollow and fraud, so you're free to either meet, you're right, you are free. But if you have not let that freedom move you to love your neighbor, you actually don't know God. You have all of this knowing, but the knowing hasn't actually caused you to move in love to the other person, then you don't actually know anything. Because true knowledge of God, true understanding of him, actually leads us to love our neighbor. So if your knowledge is leading you to be insensitive to other people and neighbors, you don't know anything. In fact, if it is just leading you to have a puffed up ego and I'm right about this and I know what's right about this and you can't prove me wrong, and Paul would even maybe say, you're right about it. Congrats, you win the being right game. If all that's doing for you though, if your knowledge doesn't move you to love, here's what he would say in verse 12. Look at verse 12 with me. He says, if that's your way of thinking about all this, thus sinning against your brothers and wounding their conscience when it is weak, you sin against Christ. You're sinning against Jesus. It says in the verse before that, because they are someone for whom Jesus died. You can't treat them this way. You can't be inconsiderate of them. You being right and holding on to your rightness in a way that does not consider your brother or your sister is a bigger sin in the eyes of Jesus. So yes, first group in Corinth, you're free to eat meat sacrificed to idols. But if you're not loving your neighbor with your freedom, then you don't actually know anything. True knowledge always leads to loving others. And if you don't love, you don't know anything. So every Christian in the room, which I know not everyone in the room is, but every Christian in the room should be asking this question. How would I turn my right way of thinking into love? How could knowledge turn into love? Which leads us, I believe, to the most fascinating verse in the entire chapter. It's the very end of his kind of opening preamble. It's verse 3. Look what he says in verse 3. But if anyone loves God, he is known by God. If anyone loves God, he is known by God. So in this section, all about what they know, what they're right about, and they're using their freedom to serve themselves instead of using their freedom to serve their neighbor. Why is he bringing up the, if anyone loves God, he is known by God? That feels like, wait, okay, true maybe, Paul, but why did you bring that up here? Like when you read the first couple of verses 1 and 2, he's begun to put the know-it-alls in Corinth in their place and humble them. He started to, like, knowledge puffs up, but love builds up, and if anyone imagines that he knows something he does not know as he ought. Like, you would think following that train of thought, he would say something like this in verse 3, but the man who loves God, he knows God. Like, okay, maybe if all you have is a theological knowledge, but you're not loving, you don't know anything, but if you love God, you do know God. But that's not what he says. He spins it. Whoever loves God is known by God. He like switches the subject. The The know-it-alls become like the passive one in this sentence, not the active one. So why is Paul using the fact that God knows us as a way of deflating our pride? How does God knowing you, being known by him, how does that deflate our pride? Well, when you and I want to be right, when we want to know something, we want to increase our knowledge, let's step back and ask this question. What's that quest all about? Like when I want to increase my knowledge of an area, or I want to be right about something, what is that saying about me at the deepest level? Like, what do you want truly when you want to increase your knowledge of money? What do you want truly when you want to increase your knowledge of business or theology or exercise or anything? When you want to increase your knowledge, what are you after? Is it possible that what we want when we want to increase our right knowledge of something, that we're really after protection? Like, if I can know more, be right more, then maybe I'll be safe from the pain. I'll be safe from surprises because I know enough to not be caught off guard. I'll be safe from the things in life that cause me anxiety and heartache. And if I can just know more, then maybe I won't be hurt or caught off or surprised by the pain anymore. Is it possible that I pursue knowledge in the areas that I am most afraid and the most insecure? See, like if I'm terrified of how my kids might turn out, hypothetically, if I'm terrified of how my kids might turn out, I will want to increase my knowledge of parenting. I'll listen to more podcasts, I'll read more books, I'll have more conversations, I'll talk to more parents ahead of me. I just want to increase my knowledge so that I can guarantee that the pain that I'm afraid of happening won't happen. So I want to increase my knowledge, but really I'm afraid and insecure, so I increase my knowledge to protect me from the pain. Or if I'm afraid of never having enough money, which will never happen in this job, but if I'm afraid of never having enough money and I have a scarcity mindset and it's never going to be enough, I'll increase my knowledge of money and how to save and how to invest and how to think and how to budget. I'll increase my knowledge of all that so that I save myself from the pain of never having to feel like I don't have enough or feeling like it's scarce and I don't know what to do and I can't provide. So I increase my knowledge of money and budgeting and investing to protect me from the pain of never feeling like I don't have enough. If it makes sense about my body deteriorating, being sick and withering, I'll seek the knowledge of health and exercise and body control. If I'm afraid of ever appearing like a fool in front of you, I'll just increase my knowledge of everything so that I at least have enough anecdotal stuff to throw at you so that I never seem like I don't know what I'm talking about. No matter what you do, I can at least throw out a few things so that I don't appear like I'm an idiot. So I'll increase my knowledge so that I can not appear a certain way to you. Because we tend to think that knowledge will protect us from the pain we're most afraid of. Which means this, at the end of the day, I'm just as insecure as you can imagine. And my ego is just as fragile as I would never want to admit to you it being. I just want the security of knowing it's all gonna be okay in the end. I want the bedrock of something or someone that will catch me no matter how many times I fall. And I want the knowledge and the assurance of someone who will always leave the light on for me, especially when it's dark, and really especially when I've made it dark. I want someone who's not going to leave me and not just not abandon me. I want someone who's never going to leave the real me, like the insecure and afraid one, the weak one. I want to know that there's someone who would never leave that guy. And in my insecurity and fear, what I do is I go on this quest for knowledge to make me feel like I'm secure and in control. So is it possible that in my quest for knowledge, what I really want is just to be known? We were all taught by Descartes in the Enlightenment, his philosopher, thinker. This mantra has carried on for centuries. Descartes would have told us that the way of finding yourself was through this realization: I think, therefore I am. I find my I am-ness, my sense of selfness, my existential security through my ability to know that I can think and reason my way through life. I think, therefore I am. Paul would give you a different path to a more secure sense of self. Paul would say, I am known, therefore I am. If anyone loves God, he is known by him. And those whom he knows, he loves. It's not your knowing about anything that can make you feel more secure or more free. It's being known and it's being loved. Being known and being loved at the same time is the greatest cry of your soul, being fully known and fully loved. And you go, but wait, hold on, Elliot. Paul said in here, if anyone loves God, he is known by him. He didn't say anything about we're loved by him too. He said we're known by him, and God's omniscient, God knows everything. So how do you know that the God who knows you is the same God who loves you? How do you know that? Well, this construction of knowledge and freedom ought to lead one to more love. This framework that Paul gives here, that the more knowledge you have ought to also increase your love. That framework, Paul didn't invent that. Jesus did. Jesus is the ultimate example and embodiment of this reality. Jesus knows the most of anybody. He's the infinite one. He's the second member of the Trinity before time began. He knows everything. Jesus is the most free being that's ever existed. No one took his life from him. He was in complete sovereign control of every breath that he took and every action that happened to him. Jesus was the one who was the most right and the most righteous. And his infinite knowledge and his infinite freedom and his infinite rightness, what did that cause him to do? It did not puff him up. Actually, the complete opposite. His infinite knowledge, his infinite freedom, his infinite rightness. What did it cause him to do? He wasn't puffed up. He became completely deflated. Like the highest knowledge, the highest right one, the most free one, used that position of knowledge and being right not to puff himself up. If anyone could have done it, it would have been him. But as Philippians 2 would tell you, he didn't consider equality with God something to be grasped, but emptied himself and became a servant, becoming obedient unto death. It's the art piece we sat in front of before the sermon. Like that lamb that was split in two, that's Old Testament covenant imagery. That's the image of Jesus. Like Jesus wasn't puffed up, he was slaughtered. At great cost to himself, his knowledge and his freedom led him to love. So if your knowledge is going to grow, here's what Jeremiah would say and Paul would say. Here's what like start to finish in Scripture would say. If your knowledge is going to grow, let it be in the knowledge of his knowing and loving you. I am known, therefore I am. And if you have a sense of self, like a secure one, guess what you can do? You can love and serve your neighbor. You can love and serve your spouse or your roommate or your coworkers, people that you disagree with, and they might be wrong, but Jesus never asked you to be right before he served you. Like, that's not the point. At great cost to himself, his infinite knowledge and infinite freedom and infinite rightness led him to love you. Let your knowledge grow in the knowledge of that. Let's pray. Jesus, it's comical to think that our egos would be puffed up when we become right about something. Like we view it rightly, so we have pride. And the gap between our ego and your existence is cosmic. And so our little sandcastles, like our little fragile states that we try to secure something for ourselves, Jesus, would you humble us? And don't humble us by inspiration only, Jesus. Humble us by experiencing your love of us, that you, the infinite one, loved us. You let your infinite knowledge cause you to serve. Would you not just make us more like that? Yes, we pray for that, Jesus. Would you help us to believe that that actually happened to us and for us, that we might become soft, we might become gentle and lowly like you? We ask all this in your name, Jesus. Amen.